This is Sparks from Radio Facts on 6205 and 12255. Fresh programmes from Radio Facts start on Monday, Wednesday, Friday and Sunday. Our address is Sparks, Radio Facts, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. If you would like a reply to your letter, which includes a station card, technical information, and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1 to Sparks, Radio Facts, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG.
Labeled with love, drinks to remember, I mean myself.
Hubble beaten to sight of most distant stars, from New Scientist by Jeff Hecht. Astronomers have seen individual stars in the Virgo cluster, the nearest major cluster of galaxies, for the first time. Direct observations of individual stars in distant galaxies can help calibrate the scale of cosmic distances and the age of the universe. Astronomers planned to make such measurements with the Hubble Space Telescope, but are prevented by its flawed optics. When Hubble was conceived, no one thought these observations would be possible from Earth. Last month's meeting of the American Astronomical Society in Seattle, Robert McClure of the Dominion Astrophysical Observatory in Victoria, Australia, reported resolving thousands of stars in the galaxy NGC 4571. The galaxy now appears to be 50 million light-years away, about half as far as many astronomers had thought. McClure and his colleagues Michael Pierce of Dominion University and René Racine of the University of Montreal added computer-controlled optics to the Canada-France-Hawaii telescope on Mauna Kea to compensate for the atmospheric fluctuations which normally blur star images. They used a comparatively simple adaptive optical system, which tracks the movement of images by tilting a single mirror. It improves angular resolution from the 0.8 arc seconds usual in the exceptionally clear air of Mauna Kea to 0.4 arc seconds, and makes the areas of star images 5 times smaller. The smaller the image, the more concentrated the light, so astronomers can detect fainter objects and distinguish between star clusters and individual stars. The distance of the Virgo cluster is a key to calculating the age of the universe and how fast it's expanding. To estimate the distance, the Canadians assumed that the brightest star in the galaxy is as luminous as the brightest stars in closer galaxies. Their preliminary results pose yet another problem for cosmologists, because they imply that the universe is only about 10 billion years old, younger than many globular clusters. Many astronomers remain skeptical about this method of determining the age of the universe. Mark Birkinshaw of the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics says they may not have pinpointed the brightest stars, adding that velocities of nearby galaxies may not match those in the universe as a whole. At the Seattle meeting, he described a new way to gauge the size of much more distant clusters by observing emissions and absorption of the gases they contain. By this method, he estimates the universe is 20 billion years old. That from The New Scientist by Jeff Hecht. Ow!
I'm back! Get up off of that thing and dance to do you better. Get up off of that thing and dance to do. Sing it now. Get up off of that thing and dance to you feel better. Get up off of that thing. Try to release that pressure. Get up off of that thing and shake till you feel better. Get up off of that thing and shake till you say it now. Get up off of that thing and shake till you feel better. Get up off of that thing and try to release that pressure. Get up off. Good God. So good. Everybody ready? Get up off of that thing and shake the you better. Get up off of that thing and shake the you. Say it now. Get up off of that thing and shake the you feel better. Get up off of that thing and try to release that pressure. Get up off of that thing and twist the you feel better. Get up off of that thing and shake the you. Say it now. Get up off of that thing and shake the you feel better. Get up off of that thing.
From the Independent Law Report, BBC Television Enterprises Limited versus Hi-Tech Extravision Limited in the House of Lords, in front of Lord Keith, Lord Emsley, Lord Brandon of Oakbrook, Lord Templeman and Lord Acner. Section 298 of the Copyright, Designs and Patents Act 1988 gives the provider of encrypted satellite programs the right to authorize persons to make or sell apparatus designed to enable viewers to receive the programs. The House of Lords dismissed an appeal by Hi-Tech from the Court of Appeal's decision that the plaintiff's claim against Hi-Tech disclosed a cause of action under the Copyright Designs and Patents Act 1988. By Section 298 of the 1988 Act, a person who A. makes charges for the reception of programmes included in a broadcasting or cable programme service provided from a place in the United Kingdom is entitled to the same rights and remedies against a person who makes, imports, or sells, or lets for hire any apparatus or device designed or adapted to enable or assist persons to receive the programmes or other transmissions when they are not entitled to do so, as a copyright owner has in respect of an infringement of copyright. The plaintiff, the British Broadcasting Corporation's commercial arm, broadcasts television programmes by a satellite system to Western Europe. The programmes were not intended for reception in the United Kingdom. The plaintiff adopted an indirect method of making charges for the reception of programmes by sending out the broadcasts in an encrypted or encoded form, which could only be viewed by using a decoder. The plaintiff had authorised the use of decoders made by and distributed by Space Communications Sattel Limited, which paid the plaintiff part of the sale price of each decoder. That's to say, they pay the BBC. Hi-Tech, without the consent of the plaintiff, made decoders capable of decoding the plaintiff's broadcasts in Western Europe for sale in Western Europe at a cheaper price than that charged by Sattel. Hi-Tech had offered to pay the same commission as Sattel paid to the plaintiff, without admitting liability to do so. The plaintiff brought an action against Hi-Tech, relying on Section 298, and sought an interlocutory injunction restraining Hi-Tech from selling any apparatus designed to enable persons to receive the European satellite service. Hi-Tech applied to strike out the claim on the ground that it disclosed no cause of action. Mr. Justice Scott struck out the statement of claim. The Court of Appeal allowed the plaintiff's appeal. Hitech appealed. Lord Brandon said that the plaintiff came within paragraph A of section 298. Counsel for Hitech argued that the persons referred to in section 298 as being persons enabled to receive programmes were persons within the United Kingdom, and because Hitech supplied decoders only to persons in Western Europe other than in the United Kingdom, paragraph A did not apply to it. It was argued that Parliament could not have intended to regulate the conduct of television users outside the United Kingdom. However, that argument was based on a misconception. Section 298 did not purport to regulate the conduct of television users outside the United Kingdom. It regulated the conduct of makers and sellers of decoders in the United Kingdom in a way which might have consequential effects on television users outside the UK. If providers of direct satellite programmes emanating from the UK were to be protected in the respect of collection of charges made by them for the reception of such programmes, that protection must, so far as practicable, have effect, albeit indirectly, in relation to reception by persons in other countries. However, it could not be disputed that any protection afforded to programme providers in relation to television users in other countries could readily be bypassed by decoders being made and sold by persons in those countries. Accordingly, the persons referred to in section 298 as being enabled or assisted to receive programmes or other encrypted transmissions included all persons, whether in the UK or outside it, who were capable, with the necessary decoders, of receiving such programmes or transmissions. Hitech also argued that the expression, quote, not entitled to do so, unquote, at the end of paragraph A, meant prohibited by law from doing so, and did not mean, as the Court of Appeal held, not authorised by the provider of the programmes to do so, and that Mr. Justice Scott took the view that there was no law of the United Kingdom which prohibited any person from receiving, by using a decoder, encrypted broadcasts. The key to the interpretation of the expression not entitled to do so in section 298 was to be found in appreciating that the whole section was concerned with the legal relationship between one class of persons, the providers of programmes and senders of encrypted transmissions, on the one side, and another class of persons, those capable by the use of decoders of receiving such programmes and transmissions, on the other. It thus became justifiable and necessary, in order to achieve the purpose of that section, to interpret the expression not entitled to do so as having the meaning not authorised by the provider of the programmes or the sender of the encrypted transmissions to do so, rather than prohibited by the law of the UK from doing so. The Court of Appeal's decision was affirmed and the appeal dismissed. Lord Keith, Lord Emsley, Lord Templeman and Lord Acner agreed. That was from the Law Report in The Independent.
I just can't wait till the day when you know.
The relevance of that last report is that high-tech Extravision is run by Chris Carey, who is also the managing director of Radio Nova, first in Ireland and then on the Astra satellite. Our friends at Radio Caroline recently borrowed this satellite channel from him. This is Sparks from Radiofax on 6205 and 12255. Sparks is every Monday, and fresh Radio Fax programmes start on Monday, Wednesday, Friday and Sunday. Our address is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. If you'd like a reply to your letter, which includes a station card, technical information and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1 to Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. Here's a track from the River City People, a reasonably well-known band in Britain, but you might not have heard of them. It's What's Wrong with Dreaming.
You can smile and say
fluids vanquish intermittent contacts. In electronics design news, by Stephen H. Liebson. Despite their best efforts, socket and connector vendors cannot deliver faultless parts. Airborne contaminants, corrosive environments, and a naturally oxidizing planetary atmosphere all conspire to degrade a connection's performance. As the quality of other electronic components continues to improve, the relative unreliability of a product's sockets and connectors emerges as a major cause of product failure. Fortunately, chemical solutions exist for these problems. If you have no experience with such products, you may consider them to be more snake oil than a remedy for product failures. But many engineers think these chemicals are a godsend. The shiny finish of a quality connector's contacts looks as though it should work well without help. Despite appearances, however, the contacts of even the best sockets and connectors aren't smooth. Their metallic surfaces have microscopic peaks and valleys. When two parts of a mating connector meet, they actually touch through a myriad contact points. A sufficient number of these contacts makes a good electrical connection. However, dirt and corrosion reduce the number of contact points and restrict the flow of current across the joint. Oxygen in the atmosphere corrodes contact surfaces that lack gold plating. Because gold is a noble metal, it doesn't readily react with other substances. Connector vendors may use gold plating to boost a contact's performance, but the corrosive gases found in many industrial environments can degrade even gold-plated connectors. Plated gold is porous, so contaminants can pass through the gold to attack the metal underneath the plating. Over several months, a sufficiently corrosive environment can strip the gold plating from a connector. When mated together with a high normal force, tin-plated contacts can form gas-tight connections that exclude oxidation and corrosion. Like a gold-plated connection, a gas-tight joint reduces the problems caused by oxidation, corrosion, and contaminants. However, mechanical vibrations and expansion and contraction from thermal cycling can cause even gas-tight connections to make and break. Each time a connection breaks, oxidation and corrosion take place at the newly exposed contact site. The result is called fretting corrosion. Fretting corrosion can cause intermittent failures, one of the worst problems to find and solve. These intermittent failures will often disappear temporarily if you unplug and reconnect the failing contacts. A formerly gas-tight connection can open permanently when a layer of insulating film composed of corrosion products builds into a contact joint. Even if the connection doesn't open, its resistance can increase from milliohms to ohms over long periods as more and more contact points open. Insulating films in contact junctions form Schottky diodes that distort low-level signals while conducting larger ones. Analog circuits that depend on such a connection may completely fail because of the resistance increase and distortion. Even digital signals can experience significant degradation in rise and fall times. You can fight oxidation and corrosion. A liquid lubricant applied to mating connections will seal that connection and prevent airborne contaminants and reactive gases from reaching the contact area. Mineral oil mixed with microcrystalline wax appears to be an adequate contact lubricant for new, uncontaminated surfaces. If you're fresh out of microcrystalline wax, or you're treating sockets and connectors that have been in service for a while, you may want to use a prepared product to strip off the existing contamination and build a barrier to corrosion. If so, consider the Cramalin family of connectors from Kaeg Laboratories. Kaeg makes two types of Cramalin, red and blue. Red cleans contacts by dissolving corrosion. After using the red variant, you wipe away the residue and use the blue bottle to protect the cleaned contacts. 2-ounce bottles of red and blue Cramalin liquid cost $15 and $16 respectively. 6-ounce spray cans of red and blue cost $8 and $9 respectively. Ben Poland detailed 7 years of experience with these products in one of his columns, The 8-Bit Alchemist, which appears in Current Notes, a magazine for Atari computer users. Poland described the chemicals on cable connectors, plugs, jacks, sockets, and particularly on dirty switches. He used red Kremlin to quiet a switch that was injecting noise into a video display after a few weeks' use. A misbehaving disk drive selector switch responded similarly. Poland also explained how he mixes preparations based on Kremlin products. He doesn't use them straight. He mixes each 2-dram bottle with sufficient trichloroethane to make 3 ounces of solution. He blends the mixes in travel-sized Glaus mouthwash bottles after carefully relabeling the bottles. Poland states that thinner Kremlin films work better. Cleaners and lubricants such as Kremlin enable connectors to perform as designed. However, these chemicals do not conduct electricity. They rely on the connector's contact points to carry current. Stabilant 22 from DW Electrochemicals is a concentrated liquid polymer that fills gaps between mated contacts and conducts current under an applied electric field. Consequently, the company claims that the substance enhances a contact's conductivity. A 15-milliliter bottle of Stabilant 22 costs $102. You can get Stabilant 22 in an 8-to-1 dilution from Sumiko in Berkeley, California. Telephone 415-843-4500. An importer of high-end audio equipment. Sumiko calls its mixture Tweak. A 7-milliliter bottle of Tweak costs $18. Like Kremlin, Stabilant 22 has its advocates. Bill Luffman, a programmer at Children's Hospital in Oakland, California, rejuvenated an ailing 15-year-old processor technology Sol computer using the product. Processor technology met its demise years ago, but its computers continue to work. Luffman added a 5 megabyte hard disk drive to his computer, and the drive has become less reliable over the years. However, Laufman felt he had invested too much of his time and money into the old CPM machine to retire it. Hard disk errors and system crashes occurred with increasing and irritating frequency. Laufman tried replacing cables and connectors, but accomplished nothing. Finally, he bought a bottle of Stabilant 22A from Personal Computing Tools, Los Gatos, California, 0800-767-6728, and treated every connector and IC socket in the system. The computer, which had been falling almost hourly, worked for months without a problem. By coating its edge connector with the liquid, Laufman also refurbished a Sol plug-in personality card that had never worked properly.
Yeah.
Fluids vanquish intermittent contacts, from Electronics Design News continued. The lack of meaningful performance specifications for these chemicals leaves you with little useful information about their effectiveness, except for qualitative anecdotal evidence. However, DW Electrochemicals has performed some experiments that provide quantitative information. In one experiment, the company used a distortion analyzer and a spectrum analyzer to measure the performance of 10 sets of 100 gold-plated edge connector fingers wired in series. The total harmonic distortion generated by the new, at least newly acquired, contacts rose to about 0.004% at low signal levels. The company hypothesizes that thin oxidation films on the contacts created Schottky diodes that rectified low signal levels and created the distortion. After aging these connectors in an electronics manufacturing shop floor for 31 days unmated, and then 31 more days mated, the edge connector contacts introduced more than twice the harmonic distortion than they did when new. Applying Stabilant 22 dropped the distortion well below the when new levels. After this test, another 62 days of aging produced no distortion increases. In a second experiment, the company treated an old and unreliable S100 bus memory board. After measuring the rise times of control signals at 10 of the memory chip's pins, the company applied Stabilant 22 to the board's ICs and sockets. The chemical improved the rise times of the observed signals by an average of 40% and produced a 70% improvement in one instance. Further, the former unreliable board worked dependably. The company theorizes that the IC socket's contacts had been exhibiting high contact resistance caused by oxidation. Because MOS memory chips have high impedance inputs, the memory ICs on the S100 bus board could continue to operate even if the junction impedances between the IC's pins and the socket contacts were several ohms. A high contact resistance between the socket contacts and the IC pins, combined with the IC's input capacitance, would degrade signal rise times and induce failures. Reducing that contact resistance thus improves the rise times. Even with these stories of miraculous cures, you should be skeptical. Don't let this anecdotal evidence convince you that contact-enhancing chemicals are a cure for all your electrical problems. You cannot remedy a fundamental design problem such as timing violations or noisy circuits through the promiscuous use of a spray can or a goop-laden brush. However, the evidence does indicate that these products can conquer oxidation, corrosion, dirt, and intermittent contacts. That was from Electronics Design News by Stephen H. Liebson. of Death by Hawkwind. This is Sparks from Radio Fax. We'd love to hear from you. Write and tell us all about yourself, where you live and what you do. I promise to give you a mention on this programme. Our address is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG. Sparks is on every Monday, and it's a weekly programme of technical news and features. If you'd like a reply to your letter, which includes a station card, technical information, and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1. And I'll repeat the address again. Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG.
Listening to Sparks from Radio Fax.
Casting my back 10 years to the girl who was next to me in school. If I put my hand upon her leg, she'd hit me with a rule. Though tomorrow won't be long, we're gonna have to play it cool. You'd be fascinated by her. She could set the place on fire. Run and get the fire brigade. Get the fire brigade. See the building start to really burn. Get the fire brigade. Get the fire brigade. If you jump, you've got to wait to turn. Friends all seem to laugh. I feel I have to make a compromise. Try to reassure myself. My head must need some exercise. Half past 10 in the morning, she just took me by surprise.
health warning for tungsten halogen lamps. This is in The New Scientist by Lee Dayton in Sydney. Desk lights with tungsten halogen lamps can increase the risk of sunburn, cataracts and skin cancer, the Australian National Health and Medical Research Council warned last week. According to Keith Locan, head of the NHMRC, Public Health Committee and director of the Australian Radiation Laboratory in Melbourne, the danger comes from the ultraviolet radiation emitted by the lamps. Tests carried out at the ARL by Graham Elliott show that at a distance of 25 centimetres, the amount of ultraviolet radiation emitted by a 50-watt light bulb is comparable to the midday summer sun in Australia. Elliott estimates that just 10 minutes near the lamp can be dangerous. The danger diminishes with the wattage. With a 20-watt lamp, safety limits are exceeded in about 45 minutes. Researchers at the National Radiological Protection Board in Britain have made similar findings. The advantage of tungsten halogen lamps is that they produce more light than standard ones and need a much lower voltage. However, the lamps operate at high temperatures and so produce ultraviolet radiation. All incandescent lamps produce radiation over a wide range of wavelengths, but the radiation is clustered around a peak wavelength, which depends on temperature. Ideally, the peak is in the middle of the visible wavelengths, but in a hot tungsten halogen lamp, the peak is shifted towards shorter wavelengths, and more radiation is emitted in the ultraviolet. Elliott measured the spectrum of light emitted by 8 types of desk lights. He found that all the lamps emitted UVA, UVB and UVC radiation, and that most of the radiation was either UVB or UVC. Scientists agree that UVB and UVC are the most harmful types of ultraviolet radiation. The sun does not produce UVC radiation. So these lamps contain radiation that people don't normally see, said Elliott. The warning from the Medical Council follows hard on the heels of a highly controversial theory about the dangers of artificial light proposed by John Ashton and Ronald Laura of Newcastle University in New South Wales. They argue that lifestyle factors not necessarily associated with the sun increase sensitivity to sunlight, which in turn can lead to more serious sunburns and skin cancer. Artificial light is one of the most important factors, they suggest. According to Ashton and Laura, artificial light is dangerous because, unlike full-spectrum sunlight, it does not trigger natural protective processes in the skin, such as the production of melanin and vitamin D. They also believe that artificial light may send false messages to the brain, which somehow mislead the endocrine and immune systems, both of which may play a role in protecting against skin cancer. That was Health Warning for Tungsten Halogen Lamps in The New Scientist.
Don't be afraid of your freedom!
I say, love me. are the words made from my granddaddy. Come, these are the words made from my granddaddy. He said nothing in this world like when a man know him free. Free from the lock, I'm set free from the key. Free like a butterfly, free like a bee. These are the words made from my granddaddy. Said it's nice to be free, nice to be free. Free from the lock, I'm set free from the key. Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Cause I'm free, do what I want, any other time.
Soup Dragons, I'm Free, and it's Sparks on Radio Facts. Here's an album I got hold of recently. It's by Kraftwerk, called Radioactivity. I thought you might be interested to hear some of it. It's from 1975 and starts off in typical minimalist style. I'll play Geiger Counter and then Radioactivity. Well, that's one case of a record that may well be improved by listening to it on shortwave, because you've probably got more ambient background sound effects. In fact, you may not have realised that that actually had had Morse code on the record, so I'll tell you now. It's Sparks from Radio Facts, and here's Elvis Costello and the Attractions' Good Year for the Roses.
I can hardly bear the sight of lipstick on the cigarettes there in the ashtray, lying cold the way you left them, but at least your lips caressed them while you packed. Or the lip print on a half-filled cup of coffee that you poured and didn't drink, but at least you thought you wanted it. That's so much more than I can say for me. What a good year for the roses, and it won't still linger there. But long could stand another knowing. Funny, I don't even care. As the door behind you closes, the only thing I have to say, it's been a good year for the roses. After 3-4 years of marriage, the first time that you haven't made the bed. I guess the reason we're not talking, there's so little left to say, we haven't said. While a million thoughts go racing through my mind, I find I haven't said a word. From the bedroom, the familiar sound, I want babies crying, goes unheard. But what a good year for the roses, many blooms still linger there. Long could stand another knowing. Funny, I don't even care.
Something for you now if you're a beginner to Radio DXing. From An Introduction to Radio DXing by R.A. Penfold, starting with the medium wave band. This is primarily used for domestic broadcasting, and stations heard on this band are primarily, but not exclusively, transmitting programmes for consumption in the country of origin. Although worldwide reception is theoretically possible on this band, in practice it is practically impossible. The problem is the enormous output from European stations operating on the band, which makes it difficult to copy weak DX stations on adjacent channels. It is also a fact that every channel in the band is used by several stations in various parts of the world. Therefore, even if a DX station is quite strong, it may still be blotted out by a comparatively local station on the same frequency. In fact, this is quite likely. Being a low-frequency band, a path of darkness is needed between the receiver and the DX station, and medium-wave DXing is therefore only normally possible during hours of darkness. Fortunately, many European stations close down late at night, and DXing conditions are not then quite as impossible as they might otherwise be. There are still a good many strong European stations to contend with, though, and medium-wave DXing is relatively difficult. Normal broadcast band DXing techniques can be used on this band, and it sometimes proves fruitful to tune to a quiet spot on the band and then simply wait to see what, if anything, changes as turns up as propagation changes. A popular type of aerial for medium-wave DXing is a frame aerial. This consists of a large square or round frame on which several turns of wire are wound. The high-impedance output of the aerial is coupled to the receiver either by a coupling winding or a tapping on the main winding, or simply by placing a portable radio inside the frame. The greater the size of the frame, the greater the signal pickup. However, in practice, it is not really feasible to use a frame of more than 1 meter in diameter, since this type of aerial is directional and is therefore normally mounted inside near the receiver. It should be mounted in such a way that it can be rotated to either peak the desired signal or null an interfering signal. Of course, it would be possible to have a large loop mounted outside and operated via a rotator, but a relatively small indoor loop seems to give perfectly adequate results in practice, and the added cost and complexity of an outdoor type is probably not justified. A frame aerial is a tuned type, incidentally, and a variable capacitor must be placed across the main winding so that it can be peaked at the appropriate frequency. Tuned aerials are beneficial in that they effectively improve the image rejection of the receiver, but do have the disadvantage of needing readjustment each time the receiver's tuning control is altered significantly in order to keep the aerial peaked for optimum pickup. If you would like to experiment with a frame aerial, or loop aerial as it's also known, a 1 meter square or 1 meter in diameter aerial will require 6 turns of about 20 SWG enameled copper wire. If the loop is made slightly smaller, it will be necessary to increase the number of turns, while a larger loop will need fewer turns. The amount of wire needed remains very much the same, in fact, providing the size of the loop is not altered very substantially. The coupling to the receiver can be made using a single turn of wire or a single turn tapping on the main winding. In order to take advantage of the excellent directional properties of this aerial, it is necessary to connect it to the receiver via a coaxial cable. A 500 picofarad tuning capacitor can be used across the main winding, but it may be found that this will not tune right down to the low frequency end of the band. This can be overcome by having a fixed 390 picofarad mica or polystyrene capacitor, which can be switched across the tuning capacitor in order to shift the frequency coverage to the lower part of the band where necessary. It is not necessary for the main winding to be especially neat, and if the turns are laid neatly side by side, slightly spaced apart, the self-capacitance of the coil will be reduced, and an extra turn will be required to give the correct frequency coverage. However, a 500 picofarad tuning capacitor may then just be sufficient to cover the entire band. The tuning of this type of aerial is quite sharp, and it is important to keep it properly peaked using the tuning control if optimum results are to be attained. This type of aerial gives maximum pickup in the direction of the winding, and minimum pickup at right angles to the coil, that is, looking through the loop, so you're looking in the direction of minimum pickup. And shortwave DXing will be after this record from Hugo Cornwall. We'll be right back.
day. Facts and figures, facts and figures, spilling out of papers every day. Upon the roads, the accidents, the robbers of the few. Wars, they take away so many more. As long as we don't know them, they remain upon the page. Next to a history book picture.
An introduction to Radio DXing, continuing with shortwave. 120, 90 and 60 metres are known as the tropical bands, as they are only used for broadcasting in tropical areas where the static interference caused by thunderstorms gives inadequate range if the medium wave band is used. In effect, then, these are the tropical equivalent of the medium wave band and are used for domestic broadcasting. These bands are used for other forms of radio communication in non-tropical areas, and this results in a good deal of interference when DXing on these bands. Also, many of the transmitters in use on this band have relatively low output powers. Nevertheless, stations on these bands can be received in the UK after dark, although they are generally quite weak and heavily affected by interference. To be successful on this band, it is very helpful to have good equipment, patience, and a great deal of skill. It is this high difficulty factor that makes these bands popular amongst experienced DXers. The 60-metre band is the main and largest of the tropical bands, incidentally. 75 metres is an international broadcast band, but is also shared with other services. As with the tropical bands, therefore, QRM can be not a problem, interference that is. Being a low-frequency band, it is normally only suitable for DXing during the hours of darkness. This is not a popular band with either DXers or broadcasters, but as with any of the lower-frequency bands, with skill and patience, it is possible to receive interesting DX stations. 49, 41 and 31 metre bands. These popular bands provide numerous short and medium distance stations during the day, and stations from further afield can be received after dark. As well as using these bands for DXing after dark, they're useful for listening to DX programmes. Like us, even. You could send some reports in, put out by many European stations during the daytime. 25 metres. This band is usually considered to be an HF one, and does provide good daytime DX with limited local reception due to absorption of the ground wave. However, it will very often provide good DX conditions after dark as well, and it does not usually fade out after dark even in wintertime. In fact, most of the DX I've heard on this band was received during the hours of darkness. 19, 16 and 13 metres are the true HF bands, which give good daytime DX and no local reception due to absorption of the ground wave. Worldwide reception is often possible with relative ease during daylight hours, although propagation conditions are not always that favourable. In winter, after darkness has fallen, these bands tend to fade out fairly quickly. In summer, though, these bands often provide signals around the clock, albeit with generally fewer and weaker signals once darkness has fallen. Finally, 11 metres. Like the 10-metre amateur band, 11 metres offers unrivalled DX possibilities when conditions are right, in theory at least. The problem is that for a great deal of the time it is of no use whatever for long-distance reception, and broadcasters seem to be generally rather reluctant to use the band, even when conditions do perk up and offer good results. In consequence, this band does not seem to reach its full DX potential. Like the 10-metre amateur band, it's normally only suitable for daytime DX reception, and only when the activity of the sun is favourable. Although it's not all it might be, this band is an interesting one and is worth trying when conditions are good. That extract was from An Introduction to Radio DXing by Robert Penfold. Somewhere in this town. This is Sparks, a programme of technical news and features, every Monday on Radio Facts 6205 and 12255, presented by Prof Parker, Trevor Brook, Ruth Phillips and Andy Bradgate. We're running a weekly unlicensed radio feature and we need your help. Send in reports of pirate stations you've heard recently. Shortwave, FM or medium wave reports are all appreciated. Our address is Sparks, Radio Facts, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG. If you'd like a reply to your letter, which includes a station card, technical information and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons or $1 to Sparks, Radio Facts, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG. We'd love to hear from you. Write and tell us about yourself, where you live and something about what you do. And we promise to give you a mention on this programme. Could be a, I might regret that because we are probably going to be flooded, but I promise. So you might have to hold me to that. Here's Hugh Harris.
By the people so their hearts wouldn't harden, by the light of the bombs in the garden.